Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 134, being recorded on the 7th of July, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale. So Kale, it's just you and me today for a change, huh?
Yeah, I guess Evan's vacay or something. He's out of office.
Yeah, he's out for 2 weeks. We're going to miss him next week as well. So, well, let's hope we can hold down the fort over here. Thanks for putting all those links in the show notes. Some cool stuff over there. What do you want to start with?
Yeah, probably the biggest one first would be, the big one for me is DocumentDB. So there's a throughput calculator up there now. So obviously DocDB has been growing in popularity, and we actually have a kind of a website, a web-based tool that you can go up to now to kind of put in like a bunch of kind of metrics around like what you're thinking about for total number of documents and maybe some, specs or estimations around how many like creates and the CRUD operations you're going to do, like creates, reads, updates, deletes per second. Mm-hmm. And then that can basically do a calculation for you and tell you how many request units per second you would need in order to support that. So that you can best size your DocumentDB backend.
Wow, that sounds pretty interesting. Yeah, they're really putting a lot of focus in DocumentDB. It's good to see that. I think we've spoken about it before. I just hope they bring down the price point just a little bit. And sometimes I find that a tad expensive, but I'm sure there's a lot of value there.
Yep.
Well, the one that I liked, with the container service, Azure Container Services, we've had that for a while now, and primarily supported the Linux-based containers, which are the more commonly used containers out in the world. But Microsoft has been working on some Windows-based containers, and now that is available in a private preview. So if any of our listeners are interested in giving this a try and have a good reason for that, maybe they have some workloads that would make sense in a Windows container environment hosted in Azure, please apply for the preview. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. But essentially, pretty much, the similar functionality that is there today for the Linux-based containers. You kind of have a choice here. You will have a choice of the DCOS or Docker Swarm, to do the orchestration. Currently, in the preview, only the Swarm is available, but eventually it will support DCOS as well. So, give that a look. See if that's something that you're interested in.
Yeah, the other one that's close to me is the management libraries. This is just, I think this is going to come out today, actually, the announcement around some simplified kind of Java libraries for managing Azure. So we have, tons of different tools to interface because Azure is a REST endpoint at the end of the day. The way that anybody interfaces with it, whether you're coming through the portal or directly through any kind of tools or whatnot, is actually hitting the REST API. So, whether we're using PowerShell on like a Windows-based system or Node.js with the Azure CLI tools, now we have another one for people who are very close to Java and who are familiar with that very much. And so basically the idea here was to create really simple kind of libraries, which is, I think that's really similar to what CLI does, where you can basically, once you've authenticated, you can, in basically one statement, do your operations, whether you're creating a virtual machine or a virtual network or whatever kind of assets you're creating. And it's nice kind of like, like our .NET SDKs and those things where we have a nice object-oriented model to do things inside of there too. So I think it's pretty cool. This is new, so basically we haven't had this before, but mm-hmm. It's out there for those who are into Java.
That's great, yeah. And finally, the migration tool that migrated the IaaS, the old IaaS or classic IaaS instances to the new ARM-based IaaS. I think they were referred to as ISV2 in one of our podcasts. But now that migration tool is generally available in the portal. And what's interesting is that it can migrate your workloads without any downtime, which is pretty cool actually that it can do that. So this way, there's no excuse to stay on the old platform, on the old classic IaaS. Get over to the new one, take advantage of all the ARM features.
Yeah, this is something, just recently I ran into this where and where this comes up, like if you're obviously if you're just coming into Azure, if you're working with anyone from Microsoft or you're just getting started, you can see there's a heavy focus around ARM, that will kind of steer you in that direction. When you hit the portal, it's going to put you in, the V2 or the ARM stuff. But where I'm starting to see like little gaps here is like the tools we talked about in the past, like libcloud and some of these ones that do abstractions above the cloud, like so the Azure would be a provider that would plug into it to allow you to do stuff. Amazon doing the same thing, and Google. But the issue is, a lot of those tools have been written, they're open source, and they have both classic mode and ARM mode. And I find people who maybe aren't quite as familiar with Azure, when they first get started, they start using classic, and it's like, it's just something to watch out for, because there's no kind of enforcement or guidance over there. It seems like on some of these tools, the latest one I was looking at was like Terraform, which does similar stuff to what ARM does, but it works cross-platform. And so it's something to watch out for if you have customers or people you're working with that are using these high-level tools like that. Make sure they're in ARM mode.
In ARM mode, yeah, I think pretty much. I guess there's still a couple of things that haven't been migrated over to ARM, right? Some of the, I think some of the services are still in the old, not available in ARM. So, but I think there's very little excuse to not use ARM these days.
Yeah.
Okay, then we have one more item, right? Did I forget something?
Yeah, the high availability checklist. So this is something that's pretty interesting for people to look at. You need to think about, I think we've talked about this too on a podcast before, but when someone sits down and is designing an HADR or BCDR strategy for how they're going to make sure, A, that their system continues to run continuously, as well as what happens when something fails, making sure that you understand all the kind of devil in the details there about timing and how things will fail over and all the different things that you need to plan for. It's not a panacea. Like when you come to the cloud, it doesn't just say like, okay, check this box and you're highly available. You really still need to have architects there who understand to work and what the kind of RTO RPO your business has, and how does that overlay with, your systems. I mean, thinking about how quickly do your databases recover. I mean, forget about the cloud. Like, just one case I ran into was Elasticsearch. So if we had 50 terabyte databases on Elasticsearch, and if that ends up taking, an hour to recover when you restart it, because that's rebuild the indexes. I mean, that has nothing to do with the cloud, but it's something you got to account for, when you're talking about, these HADR solutions.
That's correct. Yeah, it's a good point. So having an architect help you is valuable in those scenarios.
Yeah, so I guess we have a kind of a checklist up here to kind of help guide people when they're getting started down this path. But definitely something I think people should take a look at and kind of review if you're, I don't know a lot of people who aren't into HA. I think everybody is, so it's something you should take a look at.
Okay, great. That's a good list. Thanks, Kale. So, a few episodes ago, we did, I guess, a bit of a not a deep dive, but just a quick jump into the Google Cloud platform. And the way we approached that was we kind of mapped it to all equivalent services in Azure, because I always think that's the easiest way for anybody who is currently familiar with Azure to get to know the other cloud platform. And so what I thought we'd do today is we do similar mapping to AWS. And I know in the very early episodes we probably did talk about AWS because I think I've mentioned it in the past. Actually, I got the idea for this particular podcast because of a similar podcast that was there in the AWS world, and so I guess that's the granddaddy of all the cloud platforms. There's no argument about that, but I thought it would be helpful to, just to understand what's available in AWS and map it to stuff that's in Azure, just so that people get an idea. And obviously AWS has a lot of things to offer because they've been around forever, at least the cloud division. They've broken up their cloud services into what I would call fairly small chunks. So there's the list of cloud services they offer is quite extensive. So we'll have to run through this pretty quickly, otherwise we'll be here for a couple of hours. So I'm just gonna get started, and we'll hopefully most of it should be pretty straightforward. But there's a few items in here that I might need your help on, Kale, just because I don't see how where they fit into the Azure world. Like, there's no equivalent Azure thing. So when we get to that, we'll talk about it. So let's start with the most obvious one, which is the Azure, I mean the AWS EC2 or Elastic Compute, I think is how they call it. And a lot of things in the AWS world have the word elastic in them. So I guess they kind of consider their cloud to be expandable as much as you can. So EC2 is equivalent to our VMs, right? Our Azure VMs. They're really consistent in that way. Moving on to the other one, that the second one is the EC2 Container Service. Okay, which I think is obvious. That's the Azure Container Service. But they have something called the EC2 Container Registry. And I don't know if we do we have a Docker registry in Azure? Like a private Docker registry.
No, not that I'm aware of, and this is an important thing because if you're doing something where there's like a marketplace involved, typically to back up a second, Docker Hub, right? So we can create containers and the images that reside in those containers, and publish those to the repo, which in some case the public one is Docker Hub, and that's great, right? So like all you have to do is spin up. For instance, like we spun up a Linux box with Ubuntu on it, install the Docker engine on that, and then basically just do a pull, kind of like Git. We can basically pull that stuff in there and start running it. It's great, but that's public, and there's no kind of authentication or anything wrapped around that. The private repos are interesting because then you could do scenarios where someone has to authenticate before they can use them, so you can kind of not just expose it publicly to the internet. Maybe they have to kind of pay for it. Or that respect. I'm not 100% sure how Amazon is using that private repo, if it's being used for their marketplace, stuff like that, or just in general to keep things off the internet.
Well, the way I understand it is that the container registry is private to the customer. So, as a customer, if you have a bunch of Docker images that you want to share within your organization, you can do that through the registry. And
I see.
that way only people in your company can pull those down, which I think is quite valuable, honestly.
Yeah, totally.
So that's something. I'm sure our guys are working on it and they're aware of this gap, but I thought that was interesting that we don't have that yet. Okay, then moving along to the Elastic Beanstalk, and I only got to tell you, some of the AWS names are just priceless, right? The Beanstalk is one of them. I mean, right from the word, no idea what this means or what it could possibly relate to, but this is essentially their PaaS service, the platform as a service. And so I guess in the Azure world, that's our the traditional ones are cloud services, which I think we're kind of phasing away in favor of things like web apps, or the app service. So that would be kind of equivalent, although the AWS, the Elastic Beanstalk, it actually runs on actual virtual machines, just that all those virtual machines are kind of created for you automatically as you need them. In the Azure world, we're not really exposed to that level of detail. It's like, okay, you need a website, okay, here it is. We don't really correlate that to how many VMs it's running on and things like that. So I thought that's kind of one difference between the two. The plus side with the Elastic Beanstalk is that it can run both Windows and Linux-based PaaS services. I think at this point our PaaS is only Windows, correct?
Yeah, I mean that's kind of like an implementation detail. I think that it is not exposed, like just kind of the way
Right.
we model paths, right?
You can still
So,
run Java and PHP and all the languages on it. It's just running on Windows.
right.
Yeah. So I think they have that choice over. Then again, that's because they expose the fact that the VMs are kind of running specific VMs are running. All right, moving on then to AWS Lambda, and this is a very easy one. This basically correlates to the Azure Functions. So this is a serverless kind of endpoint or serverless code that you need to run. So I'm just going to, if you need just a random piece of code running at some endpoint based on some trigger or some message, HTTP message coming in, it's, you could just throw some Node.js code in there and it'll run. So that's fairly straightforward. Then they have auto scaling listed as a separate service, and I think that's fairly standard. We have auto scaling everywhere. The elastic load balancing that kind of correlates to our load balancer. I didn't see too many differences in terms of the functionality in each of these.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about their load balancer offering as far as like what level they do. I know ours is kind of at least the PaaS version of our load balancers are at like level 4 as opposed to something higher up like level 7 application level switching. I'm not sure 100% what Amazon does. Do you know?
Yeah, they have a separate one for that, for the application. I think an application load balancer. I think it's listed separately later. But yeah, it's a good question. Okay, then moving on to the so the Amazon calls them VPCs, a virtual private cloud, which is I know it's kind of sounds kind of weird, but it's actually our virtual networks, what we call virtual networks, where we take a disparate set of resources and put them all into one virtual network. They call it a virtual private cloud, or VPC. So that's the same thing. Then moving on to storage, the Amazon S3 is basically blob storage. It has multi-class of storage available, which is frequently used storage or infrequently used storage, and there's different pricing models for that. I just realized when I was researching for this kind of paper that I was have in front of me that Azure also has multi-class storage. I don't remember when did that come in? I kind of that kind of snuck in on me. Is that a recent thing?
Yeah, I don't know if it GA'd. I think it went into preview in build time, like in March.
Okay.
That we have the cool storage there right now. We don't have cold; it's just cool right now.
Right.
So when you provision a storage account, you'll see there's like another option there, like a general storage account, and then there's this special one now that allows you to pick, whether it's cool storage. Amazon has a couple different tiers that they're doing, I know, and kind of the devil in the detail there around their storage. Like as you mentioned, Sajid, the same stuff works. Like they call them buckets, where we have containers, but
Right.
similar models for how we do flat storage like that. But the one thing is just be careful with the details if you're migrating stuff, because there's different capacities between Azure and Amazon. Like how big a single blob can be and how much you can totally store and all that kind of jazz. So kind of the details there you got to watch out for if you're doing migrations to make sure, hopefully you're coming to Azure, but if you are, how making sure that it's going to be able to fit and those kind of things.
Right, absolutely. And so, just to be clear, the S3 is Well, so there's they have another service called the Elastic Block Storage or EBS, and that is more for, I guess, for the files, you know, for like file-based access versus S3, which is, I guess, just, you know, blobs. Thought I'll just mention the other one as well. They have the EBS as well. Then they have CloudFront, which is their CDN, which is what we call CDN. The Elastic File System. This is the Samba 3 server kind of thing, and I think we have Azure Files. So that would be a related service that we offer. Amazon Glacier, which is essentially what we call Azure Backup, which is, you know, very cool storage. Then there's the import export snowball. I don't know why they call it a snowball, but essentially this is the import export service where you know you send in a device and they can copy stuff on it, or you can send a device with stuff on it, and they'll copy it to your storage account. So that's the import export service. I think we call it, this call by the same name, but they call it import export snowball. The storage gateway that they have, AWS storage gateway, that's similar to our StorSimple, right? So storage gateways, the way they describe it is a way to expand on-premises storage into the cloud. So that's like our StorSimple thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Moving on to databases. They have something called Amazon RDS, which is, I guess, similar to our SQL database. You know what? I wonder what Amazon RDS. I didn't check and see what kind of database are they using. Are they using a particular vendor or their own? Yeah, you have a choice. So you have a choice between SQL Server, Postgres, MySQL, or MariaDB, or Oracle as well. And Amazon has their own called Aurora. So you kind of have a choice there. I guess in our case, we only offer SQL, right? The Oracle is not something we offer as a managed service, is it? You have to
That's
spin up
correct.
your own. Yeah.
That's correct. I think we do something similar with MySQL, right, with the ClearDB
Yeah.
integration, where it kind of makes it more like PaaS, which is what that is, yeah.
Correct. Okay. Then they have something called the Database Migration Service, which I suppose it's a utility of sort. It's not even a service, but it's a utility that you run. It runs, I think, in the browser, and you can point it to your internal database, and it will then move the entire database to your database in the cloud. Well, we don't have anything like that, right? I know we have the easy copy, but that doesn't handle databases.
I mean, we have specific integration built into SQL Server, so like that is specific to SQL Server, obviously, because our PaaS component there. But like, if you like, let's say you had an existing on-premises SQL Server database, you can basically in Management Studio, like right-click on it and do like what it's using is our Backpack technology,
Okay.
but you can actually right from there deploy it to Azure. Like inside
Oh.
SQL Server Management Studio. So you can say like, hey, I want to export this. This is my tables. It'll check to make sure it's valid, make sure there's nothing that's gonna, like a file stream or something like that might
Right.
break when you go there. And then it will actually do it, otherwise for your Azure credentials and all that stuff, and you can deploy it straight from there.
And it does the parallel uploads and everything, takes advantage of all those
I'm
features.
not 100% sure how optimal that is. Like, if you had a really huge database, I've moved databases that were a few gigs, no issue. But I haven't moved anything that's like in terabytes or anything, so I don't know how that scales. But
That's good to know. So we do have something similar just built in.
yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so then the next thing they have is the DynamoDB, which is like our DocumentDB. You know, obviously there may be a few differences here, but it's essentially the same service. It's a JSON database. ElastiCache, which I suppose now is our Redis, right? That's our only cache offering at this time, correct? We're not offering anything else.
Yeah, as a service, that's the
Yeah.
only one, yeah.
And then Redshift. Again, I love these names, but Redshift is essentially this SQL, the data warehouse, Azure Data Warehouse product. It's basically for for doing large scale data analysis. Then moving on to networking, we have the AWS Direct Connect, which is an express route. It allows you to connect the on-premises with Azure or data centers over a high-speed network. Then they have the Amazon Route 53. Okay, can you guess what service that maps to?
I have no
Everybody else.
idea.
That's why I love these names. This is a DNS service.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't know why they call it Route 53.
Well, port 53 is DNS.
Oh, there you go. See? I knew there
Yeah.
wouldn't be a good reason for that. So it's Route 53. Okay, then they have the Amazon EMR or the Elastic MapReduce service. Of course, that would map to our HD Insight offering. The data pipeline, which from what I could see, mapped directly to Dataflow. you mentioned earlier about the Elasticsearch, right? Elasticsearch service. Didn't you say something earlier? So they actually have a service specifically for that. Now we don't have a service, right? But we do have some VMs that have that. Is that it?
Back up a sec. So you said it's Elasticsearch?
Elasticsearch service.
Yeah. I'm not 100% sure if they're just using the off-the-shelf Elasticsearch and kind of orchestrating it for you and kind of building it out for you, but our offering in search is Azure Search, right? It is a PaaS offering.
Correct, correct. And they have a separate, I think they have a separate search as well, but this is
Okay.
specifically for to support the
Elastic.
Elasticsearch
Yeah, I see.
facility. Yeah. Then they have Amazon Kinesis. I hope I pronounced it correctly. Kinesis. Well, as you might not realize, it's this is the stream analytics service. To I guess analyze stream of data. Amazon Machine Learning is obvious, and they have something called Amazon QuickSight, which is basically our Power BI analytical tool for data analysis. Now Power BI, I notice in Azure we call it Power BI Embedded. Why that difference? Does that just let you embed it in your own applications? Is that how it's supposed to work? It's not really a service, right?
I think the model there, and this is a good thing, we should probably bring someone on from Power BI at some point. I don't know if we've done that yet, but I think the idea there was originally we built the Power BI product, which was a separate service kind of thing that you could bring your data, and it was kind of like a reporting tool, what you could build dashboards and all that kind of stuff. But people said instead of just being able to come to like Power BI in that case and have your different tenants and those things set up there for inside your business to say, here's my IT stuff or whatnot. What if we could just take pieces, like build it over there in Power BI and then kind of, for lack of a better term, like iframe it and put it out into your actual application. I think that's the thing for embedded, but I'm not a Power BI expert. We should probably get someone on the show about it.
Okay, cool. Then they have something called workspaces. Okay. And the way they describe it is that it's a fully managed, secure desktop computing service which runs in the cloud. And they allow you to provision virtual desktops both for Windows and Mac computers, Chromebooks, iPads, Kindle Fires, and Android tablets. So that's definitely a service that we don't have, correct? I don't think we
Yeah,
offer.
the only way to run client OSs on ours is if you're in MSDN. You can run Windows,
Right.
but other than that, yeah, we're not licensed to run Mac
We're not.
OS or any of that
Right.
stuff. Yeah.
I wonder how they got around that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Then they have something called WorkDocs, which to me look like SharePoint on Office 365. It's in a collaborative environment. And they have something called WorkMail, which of course is our Exchange offering on O365. Moving on, they have the AWS IoT, which kind of mapped a lot for the most part to our IoT hub. Then they have let's see, AWS Mobile Hub. Again, I think that kind of maps to our mobile apps. API Gateway is our API management. right? With a big proxy server that we have for APIs. Amazon Cognito. This is their, I guess their directory service, right? That allows you to authorize users. And I suppose, what do we call that? Simple auth, is that what it's called? Where you can very easily add authorization to your applications now.
I mean, there's service principles inside Azure Active Directory. That's kind of the model that we're going through now. Is that what you mean?
No, you know the way you can, if you have a web API or an ASP.NET application today, or an MVC app for that matter, if you just want to quickly protect it with an AD based credential
Oh.
system, isn't that called simple auth or easy auth? What do we call it? You know, but it was just a click button and it automatically added it to your application. I can't remember now. But
Yep.
this, yeah, the I think the Cognito is very similar to that, the Amazon
I
Cognito.
see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where you can just very quickly have authorization in your application.
So very little code,
Yeah.
just enable a feature. Yeah.
Yep. Then they have something called the device farm. Essentially, they make all possible mobile devices available for you in the cloud for testing. So if you need, a different browsers on different devices to be test for testing purposes, they can provision that for you. I don't think we have anything like that in Azure.
Yeah, it kind of maps to the one that's big in that space right now is Perfecto Mobile,
Okay.
an external company that does that kind of stuff. Like they have every device, and you basically can bring your stuff and run it on there for testing and performance and all that stuff. So it's interesting. I didn't even know Amazon was doing that.
I know, yeah. They're kind of all over the place over here. Then they have something called the mobile analytics, which, from what I could see, kind of mapped to our mobile engagement, which we had somebody on the podcast. We had a podcast episode on that just recently. AWS Mobile SDK. I mean, I suppose that's there. We have it all in Azure SDK now, where if you have to make calls from, to say, the blob storage from your mobile device and things like that. An interesting one is the SNS or the Simple Notification Service. This, I think, it kind of mapped to our PubSub, right? Azure PubSub. This also maps a little bit to the Notification Hub because they say that you can do the SNS from mobile devices as well. I suppose you could do PubSub from mobile devices as well. So maybe it's more of the PubSub and less of the Notification Hub. Then they have a bunch of developer tools, and most of them, almost all of them, are supported in VSTS. So I didn't see anything that was an issue over there. Quickly moving on to management tools, we have Amazon CloudWatch, and this kind of mapped to our application insights. Essentially, it's a way of doing keeping an eye on how your applications are performing, issues, and things like that. And they have CloudFormation, which the way they describe it is it's their way to automate deployments, And of course, we have automation, Azure automation. So they provide templates and things like that. I guess in our case, it'd be ARM templates, and then you can use Azure automation to deploy complex workloads with just one click. CloudTrail is another one. This is one that I don't think we have. I thought it was very interesting. And what it does is, there's a bunch of I suppose we have a bunch of Azure APIs that we use, SDK APIs, which result in different things happening in Azure, right? People could be provisioning or just creating tables, creating blobs, reading blobs, and so on and so forth. And they're all using these Azure APIs. And what this does is it keeps a track, a trail, an audit trail of all those changes that are happening within your system. And that's what the CloudTrail does. It's an audit trail of everything that happens in your system. So if you ever want to go back and say, why was this, queue created over here, you can go back and see exactly who created it. I don't know if we have something that specific, do we? Like, I guess we could turn on logging, but I don't know if they have ever.
Well, I mean, we've kind of evolved there too. We used to have operations logs, but now, so basically, there's two different types of logs in Azure. There's a control plane and data plane. This, I believe, matches up more with the control plane. So basically, it's not application level; it's more cloud level. Saying all the CRUD operations you do to Amazon in this case are going to be logged there. Like if you create something or delete something or make change some configuration, we have the same thing with auto logs now. And it's kind of standardized, and there's been a lot of enhancements there around. We expose that through event hubs now, as well as customers' provisioned storage accounts. So the whole we've kind of expanded that pretty significantly just recently.
So we do have, we call them, what do we call them? Audit logs?
Audit logs, yes.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Then they have something called the AWS command line tool. Of course, we have the Azure JavaScript and Node.js tool as well, which is cross-platform. They had something interesting called AWS config, and you'll have to tell me if we have something like this. I couldn't find anything. It's a fully managed service that provides you with an AWS resource inventory, configuration history, and configuration change notification to enable security and governance. I don't even know what that really means, but I guess, I mean, we don't have like the entire. Our entire configuration is not stored in one config file, is it?
No, but we have stuff that fills each one of those things that you're talking about there. So, being able, so if you took one of those things you said, like being able to be kind of alerted when certain changes happen or enforce kind of policies at that level. I mean, we have two different policy engines. We have the ARM policies, and then we have resource locks to kind of guard against that stuff. Locks is more just like making sure people can't delete stuff inadvertently. But the ARM policies are kind of interesting because they're programmable and you can kind of control, if somebody tries to do X, I need to do this. It's like one of those IFTT things, where it can watch for certain things and then based on it, take a certain action. I
Got it.
think we have some parallel there, but
Something.
it's a variety of different tools. It's not just like one tool, and like you said, it's not just one big config,
Got it. Okay, that's good. Thank you. Then they have the Azure Management Console, of course. That's like our portal, so that's fairly consistent there. They have something called OpsWorks, and from what I could see, that was similar to our Operations Insight, and perhaps a little bit into our Operation Server integration. Then they have something called the Service. The AWS service catalog. And what this one, I mean, I wasn't 100% sure if we have something like this. The way they describe it is that it's a service allows organizations to create and manage catalogs of IT services that are approved for use on AWS. So, similar to the Docker registry we talked about earlier, right? Where you want to provision a bunch of things or create a bunch of templates that can be used within your organization. So this would be something on that route. I don't know. I have a feeling that with the enterprise version of Azure, with an Azure account that has, from an enterprise accounting perspective, don't they have that capability where you can define all these things at the enterprise level and then sub departments get to pick and choose which ones they want to use?
Yeah, I think our parallel to this would be RBAC. I don't know that their RBAC works like ours does in our model and custom rules. So basically, we could create custom rules, and then you don't even see those pieces, right? So like you would create groups or specific users and say this guy's only allowed to do these five things with these three resources. And then you could define it, and that's all he sees when he logs into the portal or tries to hit it through the API or something.
I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But you can create a bunch of, say, VMs, VM images, and put them in a service catalog, right? So that, let's say, when your departments go in and say, "Hey, I need a new Windows image or a new Linux image," they're only going to see the ones that you've authorized, correct? That you've provisioned. They don't want you just creating like
Oh,
a.
I see what you're
You
saying.
see,
Yeah,
I think that's what they
not
do over
using the
here.
market, not using the marketplace
Yeah,
images
they
and
don't want
stuff. Yeah.
people just spinning up, random Ubuntu images. You see,
Right.
they want to provision a bunch of like maybe 10 of them that they have authorized, and have only allowed those to be used. So I think
I
that's
think ours is pretty coarse grained from that level. Like being able to, you basically either have access to the marketplace or you don't.
right.
And yeah, like you said, with the EA, with the enterprise accounts, you can basically disable. I think it's disabled by default, actually.
Right.
You have to enable it. But yeah.
I think, yeah, so we may be able to do some of that there. And they have something called the Trusted Advisor, which is something that's supposed to analyze the performance of your applications and make suggestions. I think now we have that built into the portal, right? Didn't we have somebody on recently that was talking about it?
Yeah, Bernardo,
Bernardo,
Resource Health. Yeah.
right. Okay, cool. That's great. Okay, what else do we got here? Then we go into security, and they have, most of the stuff. Well, so the identity and access management, of course, is our AD and RBAC model, as you mentioned. Then they have a bunch of things around certificate management, HSM, and of course, that's our Key Vault, right? We can do pretty much everything there. Amazon, they also have the Amazon Inspector, which I saw as being equivalent to our security center, right? Which kind of goes in and looks at all the security issues that you might have in your app or in your configuration. They have a directory service, so, and that's our AD. And of course, I think that's pretty much it that they have over there. They also have something called the WAF, which is, let me give you
Web
the.
application firewall.
Web application firewall. Yep. So it allows you to, so this is something, I don't know if we have something like this?
We don't do first party there. Ours are partner provided, so something like Barracuda. There's a few of them out there in the marketplace right now that you can provision, and they're specifically called WAFs. So yeah, that's how we.
Okay.
Ours are through partners. Yeah.
Okay, got it. That's what I thought. Then I think we already, the app stream is something that they have, and that is essentially remote app, right? The remote app service where you can kind of stream apps from the cloud. Then I talked about cloud search, and you asked earlier, so that's our the search product. That's the kind of Amazon's own native search system. They have something called the Elastic Transcoder, and I suppose that kind of maps to our media service in some way. But I think our media service has a lot more to offer besides transcoding. So I thought that was something that was unique. Then they have a bunch of things that, like they have a payment service, And I don't, we don't have a payment service, right, that we offer in Azure.
Yeah, I'm not 100% familiar what they're using it for, but I mean, is it something you can set up to actually like an e-commerce type engine you're
Yeah,
talking about?
it's essentially just accepting credit cards and whatnot.
Yeah, we don't do that. I mean,
We're
obviously we have partner solutions to do that stuff, but we don't nothing first class first party, yeah.
Then they have something called the SES, which is their secure email service, and of course, I suppose that's like our SendGrid. And we had Sam Gabor on recently who talked about that. Then they have SQS, the Simple Queue service, and that's our Azure queues. It's essentially just a simple, a REST-based queue. And then they have the Simple Workflow, which we don't offer workflow. I mean, we offer BizTalk, right? Which is our workflow engine, but we don't have like a simple workflow in the cloud, do we? I don't think we have any other service that does that.
I mean, we have a couple different tools to do that kind of function, right? So Logic Apps could be thought of as a workflow engine, a very simple one. I'm not sure. It probably the features I don't know are like one to one here. It's not the kind of binary, but and then also we have Data Factory to do workflows as well. So I guess it would just depend on what you're trying to orchestrate. Yeah. Yeah.
Data frame. Yeah, right. But this is like more for, application workflows, right? I think
Yeah.
so yeah, I think you're right. Logic Apps and BizTalk are both good examples. Then they have something for game development, which is Amazon Lumberyard. I don't think we have anything like that. We don't have like a Unity thing, right, in Azure yet.
No, I mean we have Unity support in Windows, just nothing. There's not like any like pre-baked kind of stuff up there that's pre-provisioned for the user to create an environment to develop games. Yeah, that's true.
Right.
We don't not have that yet.
Okay, so yeah, so that's the whole list. I know it took a little bit of time to go through that. I just wanted to share my kind of opinion, because we talked about the Google Cloud and now we talked about the AWS Cloud, and you know, I was trying to think about like what's the basic difference, right, between these. The way I look at it is that all three of them, as you have noticed, and I'm sure our listeners have caught on to as well, is the essential building blocks are pretty much similar in all three of these major cloud platforms. So if you're an application developer that wants to build an app in the cloud, you could choose any one of these and be successful, I think, right? They all offer the basic building blocks. They all offer the reliability and the scalability and whatnot. What I think it changes from each of the clouds is how long it's going to take you to build your application. Okay, that's what's going to be different for each of the cloud offerings, and how much it's going to cost to both run it and to support it in the long run. I think those are in my mind, those are the key differences in the kind of, you know, which will determine which will come out of which cloud you pick. And like in my mind, you know, the AWS and the Azure, they have a lot more robust offerings that can help you reduce your time to market. Whereas the Google Cloud is a little bit rudimentary, but it has all the basic building blocks for sure. So that's my opinion on it. You know, on the general difference between the three cloud platforms. Any thoughts, Kale?
No, I agree in general. I mean, I think the AWS and Microsoft are probably have the most features, or like most different features, as opposed to, not a negative towards Google, it's just that they've been in the space longer, and we've had a lot of stuff we've been developing over the years that got migrated to the cloud too. So I think those have slightly more features than something like the Google platform at this point, just in raw features, to say it like that. Other than that, yeah, I think you're dead on that. I think that it's just in the details, figuring out like what makes sense for you, and also if you're doing migrations or whatever, figuring out to make sure that whether the differences between them. I mean, those things are, you got to watch out for. I think the one big thing we talked about, the cloud formation templates with Amazon. I think we should probably have an episode again about ARM. I know we've had a few of them, but there's something there to talk about, because if you look fundamentally at how people have been doing this over the years, mm-hmm. with cloud vendors and even Amazon, if we forget about Azure for a second, they're basically, they have an API, and those templates are going to execute against that API, where I think we've taken a fundamental different approach, which maybe doesn't look like it on the surface, but it really is the ARM templates are native inside the cloud, right? So we are not hitting the endpoint. Like, we're giving the template to our cloud platform and say, do this, and it can parallelize that and do that stuff behind the scenes, as opposed to making a bunch of API calls into an interface.
Right.
I think that's it's a key differentiator on some of the stuff that we've been working on to make it easy to spin up and replicate this infrastructure.
Yep.
But we should talk more about that in another episode, but I think those are I think Amazon's really mature, I mean, because they've been in the space the longest. So they have a really mature offering, and they have a lot of, I mean, we have a ton of VMs now, if you take just pure compute, looked at all the different ways that you could size them. You know, there's details there too about, like, I really don't need disk, I need a lot of CPU, or I just need lots of memory. You know, they've been through that pain over the years, and so they have a huge catalog, and we, you know, we're getting there, and I think we have a pretty good offering right now, but it takes some time. You know, you have to experience and figure out, like, which ones work best, and then based on what your customers are using. I know Amazon does similar things, where they have some, you know, high-level things that are watching their cloud infrastructure to see, are these particular SKUs taking off, or is nobody using them? And we're doing the same things for capacity planning, as well as planning for future. Do people need stuff with more memory in it and less disk, or vice versa, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Another thing I'd kind of just more on the app dev side is, in the Google, And both Amazon and Azure, of course, they have a very good support for .NET, okay, in almost all their offerings. The Google Cloud was the .NET offerings are very, very poor. They're there, but they're very poor. So that's the one difference that, if you're a developer that is already very familiar with .NET, that's something to consider. All right, I guess we'll call it a wrap then, Kale. Thank you very much for all those great points and for correcting some of my things that I wrote I was talking about.
Yeah, no
It's
worries.
good to have a second pair of eyes and ears on that. All right, then we'll meet up next week. So we have something special planned for next week, right? You're going to be where? Out in London, I believe.
Yeah, I'll be in the UK.
Okay, so I know we're trying to do this, but hopefully we can do that special UK episode next week. So that'll be cool. All right, great. Thanks a lot, Kale.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.